Okay, so just a bit of a recap. We've been looking at stories and symbols in the Buddhist tradition. Yeah, so we've been looking at stories and symbols in the Buddhist tradition as a way of explaining the Dharma. And more recently, we've been looking at these stories and symbols within the framework of Sangharakshita's system of spiritual development, integration, positive emotion, and at the moment we're looking at spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. We realise you can't really have one without the other, so we're looking at both of them together. So this evening we're going to look a bit at yidams, which I'll explain what they are in a minute. But basically, well, you wouldn't be able to talk about spiritual rebirth without talking about the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that you see in most Buddhist countries. If actually in all of the Buddhist traditions, you see some sort of archetypal, at least a Buddha, or maybe some Bodhisattvas as well. And we've got them dotted all around the centre. So, in a way, they embody spiritual rebirth. And when Sangharakshita talks about this stage, the spiritual rebirth stage, in the system of spiritual development, he talks about it in terms of the meditation that you take up as an order member, which is a visualization of a particular Buddha or a Bodhisattva figure. So that's what we're gonna take as our theme. Actually, for the next few weeks, we're going to look at different archetypal figures in the Buddhist tradition, and unpack what they mean a little bit, because they're rather mysterious and unpindownable. But we'll try and explore a few of the key figures and some of the figures that we like, because it's good to talk about something that you like. So that's what we're going to be doing in the next few weeks, actually, and that will be pretty much until the end of this series of talks on a Tuesday night. So to explain about these archetypal figures, in a funny kind of way, you have to go back to the original words of the Buddha. So some of you will have heard of the Pali Canon, and some of you won't. The Pali Canon is a written down version of an oral tradition that came from the time of the Buddha. So the Buddha's teachings were carried on in an oral tradition. They were repeated and recited every full moon by all the Buddha's followers, and eventually they were written down, and it's that written version that is the Pali Canon. It was written in Pali and is meant to be basically the original word of the Buddha. So it's the very basic Buddhist texts that all Buddhist schools will be familiar with, and that is meant to represent the original words of the Buddha. So it's the earliest tradition in Buddhism. And if you were to pick up a book on the Pali Canon, which there are quite a few, it takes up about a bookshelf in our reference library. It's quite a big volume of series of volumes of texts. If you were to look in those texts, what you will find is an emphasis on spiritual death, and a particular version of spiritual death. Because in Buddhism, and for the Buddha, the crowning delusion, the crowning misunderstanding that leads to suffering for human beings, is that we are separate from each other, that we are fixed and unchanging. We have a fixed and unchanging nature. So Buddhism says, in a way, we've got this wrong idea that we're isolated from each other, that we can't change, that we have this nature, or Atman, that's fixed and unchanging. And because we've got this view, we act it out. Unfortunately, views don't stay in a little quiet corner and get on, with themselves. You know, they do come out and manifest in behaviour. So what happens to human beings is they've got this view of a separate and fixed selfhood, and they act it out through self-preoccupation, by thinking that they're the centre of the universe. I think, pretty much, I'm the centre of the universe, and you're kind of arranged outside me, but, you know, pretty much the whole universe revolves around me. It's sad that I think that, but that's basically what I think. And what human beings do with this view of separate selfhood is that they try and bolster up their identity, both by grabbing things in the world and through their actions with interactions with others. So basically, because I think I'm separate, because I think I'm isolated from other human beings, I try and confirm my sense of self all the time by amassing more stuff. So I want the nicest jacket, and I want a jacket that kind of really symbolises the true me, that really says something about me and my personality. You know, I don't want to dress in lumberjack shirts from Oxfam. Definitely not, no thank you. What I would like is a rather stylish leather jacket and a really nice, actually, not sure how really nice this is, but anyway, silver and grey sparkly cardigan, I think says quite a lot about my personality. So we're trying to amass things from outside ourselves to really confirm who we are. We want the right sort of car, we want the right sort of house, right sort of clothes. And more than that, we want to bolster up our ego identity by getting more praise, by getting status, by our careers, by what our careers say about us, by what other people say about us. So all the time we're looking from outside of ourselves to kind of bolster up this ego identity, this kind of story that we've made about ourselves. And we want all those things so that in some way we could say, yeah, this is me. I am Vajratara. These are the clothes I wear. This is where Vajratara should live. This is what Vajratara should do. This is what people should say about Vajratara. And that all gives an impression of me. And me as being separate from other people. Me as being isolated from other people. And what this kind of whole movement to creating ourselves is called craving in the Buddhist tradition, or thirst. So Trishna. Trishna is craving, and it's this what Bhante calls the flame of desire that burns unsatisfied from birth to birth. We want to own, we want to obtain, we want to exist as separate and fixed. And sometimes we want to, because we want to create ourselves and separate and fix, some of us sometimes actually want to abandon that all and not exist. So there is in craving, craving for sensory experience, craving for existence, and sometimes even craving for non-existence as well. We've got this story about our existence, and sometimes we just want to smash it to pieces. So that's craving. But the problem about all this movement, trying to crave things from outside of ourselves, is that it doesn't work. It doesn't work because we're not separate from other beings. We're not separate from each other. We're not separate from the world. And we're not fixed. We're always changing. We don't have any choice about that. We're always changing. And we look for satisfaction for things. We look for a sense of existence and meaning and purpose in things that can never give us satisfaction or meaning or purpose. You know, that H&M cardigan starts to go bobbly after a while, evidently. The house, it just doesn't really do it. It doesn't really confirm your identity. It's just a place to live. All these things that we do, the praise, well, it comes and goes. Sometimes you get a bit of praise and sometimes you get a bit of blame. All those things that we do to kind of create our identity don't work. They don't work. The more they don't work, the more we want them. The more we want more and more and more. I found a great quote, actually, in the Pali Canon today that said, were the Himalayas made of yellow gold, twice that is not enough for one man's wants. To know this is to act accordingly. So even if the Himalayas were made of yellow gold, twice that is not enough for one man's wants. And the main issue in Pali Canon is this idea of Trishna is constantly wanting. And the Buddha's answer to this is, he says, well, just stop, actually. Stop looking to the world. Stop looking to get more stuff, to confirm your sense of identity. Stop looking for praise. Stop looking for status. Stop looking for pleasure to give you all that you want, because it's not going to do it for you. He says, just stop. Just stop. Let go of that craving. Stop looking for the world to fulfill your desires. And stop trying to impose your ego onto others. Stop trying to impose your ego onto the world. And just be with whatever's going on in your experience at the time. And there's another quote I found. He says, though the sky may split, though the earth may quake, though all beings feel fear, though men may drive a dagger in his breast, no Buddha will ever turn for help to worldly things, the essentials of existence. So the whole kind of thrust of the Pali Canon is just stop, actually. Stop looking for satisfaction in things that just can't give you satisfaction. And the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, is defined by the Buddha. He says it's that that leads to dispassion, to detachment, to dispersal of wealth, to modesty, to contentment, to seclusion, to energy, and to simplicity. So the whole kind of thrust is like, yeah, just stop, actually. Just be at peace with what you have. Which I have to say, on occasion, when you look in the Pali Canon, it's a little bit dry. And I have found this, sometimes people ask me this question, which I have come to dread, which is, I've got to give a reading at a wedding, and I was wondering if you could suggest anything from the Buddhist tradition. And you just think, oh God, no. Well, you don't think, oh God. You think, oh Buddha. Really don't go there. Buddhist tradition, not good for weddings. Something that leads to dispassion, to detachment, to modesty, to contentment, to seclusion, and to simplicity, really isn't going to do it at a wedding. So it can have a little bit of a thrust of, oh my God, what have I let myself in for? But, and there is a but to this, the Buddha did also teach spiritual rebirth. He taught spiritual death in terms of letting go of your expectations for the world, but he also taught spiritual rebirth. Because if we're talking about a flame of desire that burns from birth to birth, you can't put out that fire just by sitting on it. You can't but put out that fire by pretending it doesn't exist. I've said this, it's a quote from Kisa Gotami, but she calls humanity the restless and passionate humanity. And that's who we are. We're restless and we're passionate. And at this stage, I don't think it's enough to just go, I'm just going to stop wanting things from the world. I'm just going to stop my desire. Because we're beings who desire, who have emotions, who do desire. And I think at this stage, what you have to do is, instead of just trying to turn away from things that don't work, I think you have to turn towards things that do work. And put that desire into something that's really going to do it for you. So, and the Buddha does talk about this as well. He talks about Shraddha, except for it's not called Shraddha in Pali, it's called something else. Or it's Saddha. Yeah, I'm not even going to try and spell that. Unless I just put a lot of H's in it, because Pali has a lot of H's. Anyway, so, Saddha, or Shraddha in Sanskrit, let's just keep with the spellings that I know, that I have even written down, Shraddha in Sanskrit, is what the term that we that's used for faith in Buddhism. But I think faith, the English word faith, has a lot of connotations that aren't really anything to do with Buddhist faith. So Buddhist faith, Shraddha or Saddha, is has three elements to it, and one of them is conviction. So it's when you see, say, the Buddha's teachings as real, as a true account, a profound account of the way things really are. And you think, oh, yeah, actually, that's right. You hear it and you think, yeah, that's right. So there's conviction. This is a kind of a cognitive element of faith. And then there's attraction, which is, Subhuti calls it a delighted fascination. There's a fascination in the Buddha's teaching. You don't just see them as true, you sort of see them as deeply desirable, as even beautiful, beautiful to behold. And then the third aspect is longing faith. And to me, well, we kind of got the cognitive aspect, we've got the emotional aspect, but this is more the volitional aspect. And to me, I think this is in a way the most beautiful aspect of faith. It's that longing to be united with the object of faith. So in this case, the longing to be united with the Buddha or with the Buddha's teachings. The longing to be at one with those teachings. It's like you see where you are and you see where the Buddha is, and you don't just think, oh God, I'll never get there. You just long to be with the Buddha. Just like you long to be with a lover. You long for the Buddha. So this is longing faith. And I think in a way this more accurately describes where to put all this desire. So that you're not just cutting off your desire. You're not just sitting on that flame that burns from birth to birth. Actually, you're moving it. You're redirecting it into something that will work, into the Dharma, into the Buddhist teachings. And instead of desiring for a car or clothes or a new boyfriend or a new girlfriend or whatever it is that you're wanting from the world, you put all that longing onto the Buddha and the Buddha's teachings. And in a way, it's essential that you do, because along with this, along with longing faith, along with desire, along with thirst, is energy and is action and will. And unless you put all that desire onto the Buddha, onto the Buddha's teachings, it's going to go somewhere else. So when you put it onto the Buddha's and the Buddha's teachings, it's like you suddenly get the energy that you need. Just as when you fall in love with someone, suddenly it's terribly easy to go on long journeys and to get up early in the morning if there's the promise of them at the other end of it. In the same way, if you love the Dharma, well, you just become a fool for love. And you'll do anything. You'll do anything just to be at one with the Dharma. And meditation is just like throwing yourself into your lover's arms. It's just like being united with the one true thing that really matters in all the world to you. Which basically means that the whole Buddhist path is a delight. It's not something heavy. It's not something that you shouldn't mention at weddings. It's a true delight. Sorry, slightly went off there. Anyway, so longing, yeah, okay. Shraddha and longing. So what are we longing for? What is possible? It's a longing for what is possible. So what is possible? What do we desire in the Dharma? And I suppose the answer to that is to, just in shorthand, obviously it's different for every person, is to fulfill our spiritual potential, or in other words, to be enlightened, or in other words, to be spiritually reborn. That's what we long for. And going back to the time of the Buddha, well, he didn't leave that side of Buddhism out. He said, well, in a way, you can't really say anything about enlightenment. And sometimes he talks about it in negative terms, such as the extinction of craving, extinction of Trishna. But sometimes he also talked about it in positive terms, even in poetical terms. So he says, in the midstream standing, in the fearsome flood, for those overwhelmed by decay and death, I'll tell you of an island where all these things shall be no more. Possessing nothing and craving nothing, this is the island, the incomparable island. That is the ending of decay and death. Nibbana I call it, that is the island. So sometimes it's like, you know, he's talking all this stuff about you know, not expecting satisfactions out of things in the world. And then he'll just go off in this kind of poetical flurry, which is really beautiful, actually. Sometimes in the Pali Canon, it's quite dry, and then there's this beautiful little gems of poetry. Sometimes I just imagine the Buddha, you know, slightly staring off into the distance, and just all this poetry coming out. So there was a bit of poetry there for you to hook your desire onto. But more important than all that poetry was the Buddha himself. So his whole being exemplified spiritual rebirth. His whole being personified what you could become. What was the answer to spiritual rebirth? And what you could long for and what was possible. He represented all those things. And, you know, if you read the Pali Canon, you get a sense of his tremendous presence. You know, he'd say a few words and, you know, here's me in 2007. I read those words and I think, yeah, that kind of makes sense. But I'm not enlightened. But obviously, 500 or so years before Christ, he said those words to someone and they just got it. And they just got it because he said more than the words themselves. He was the words. He was it. And his presence really communicated something. And you get a sense of this because they say, like, the Buddha had elephant eyes. Well, what does that mean? Well, the Buddha had elephant eyes because when he looked at someone, his whole presence was concentrated on that person. Apparently, an elephant can't look at you unless it goes straight full on you with all its attention. So you get this idea of this huge elephant just turning around and really facing you and really taking you in. And that's quite a tremendous image, actually. And they call him the lion of men, who speaks with the lion's roar. Now, I don't imagine that the Buddha shouted very much. Or did sound like a lion roaring in the jungle. But it's something like this. Well, when the lion roars, everybody listens. And when the Buddha, the lion of men, roars, everybody listens. I have to say, I know someone else like that, which is Sangharakshita. When Sangharakshita talks, everybody listens. And when Sangharakshita looks at you, even though he's almost blind at the moment, he really takes you in. So I have to say, I think that Sangharakshita is the lion of men. But anyway, you know, I'll just go over that. So, so the early Buddhists weren't unaware of the significance of the Buddha's presence, the Buddha himself. And in the early monastic Sangha, for the early Buddhists, one of their main practices was recollection of the qualities of the Buddha. This sometimes gets left out of history, but actually it was a very, very important practice, a meditation practice, where they would sit down and they would recollect the qualities of the Buddha. And they didn't just do that by reciting a list of words, but they really brought him to mind in their imagination. You know, some of them had met him, maybe some of them hadn't, but they really brought him to mind. You know, well, what did he look like when he said that, and what did he say, and how was he, and where was he, and how did he hold his body, you know? And so it was a very important practice at the time of the Buddha. And I think it was an important practice because it's not enough to just let go of desire. You need to put that desire into something. You need to have your spiritual death, but you also need to have your spiritual rebirth. Your longing for what is possible and your knowledge of what is possible right in front of you. So that was the kind of practice which worked very well as long as either the Buddha was alive or people had got to know the Buddha. But obviously it changed slightly when he was dead. And one thing actually I've been recently reading about is that people did have spontaneous visualizations of the Buddha. They'd be deep in meditation and it would be like the Buddha would just appear to them and go through a whole kind of series of dreamlike imagery. And then what would happen was that they would give that kind of imagery to someone else as a practice to take up. So other people would take that up as, well, you know, if you just imagine the Buddha like this and he's sitting like this and he does this and he does that, You give that to someone as a tradition. They do that kind of visualization practice, and then they get the same experience as you've had. And that's very important that they did that, because it got made much bigger in the later traditions of Buddhism. So in the later traditions of Buddhism, what you had was this movement called the Mahayana, or the Greater Vehicle, around the time of Christ. Yeah, so around the time of Christ, there was a bit of a renaissance in Buddhism. And a new movement called the Mahayana arose, which re-emphasized the altruistic dimension of Buddhist practice. So they were saying, well, it's not enough to just give up looking for satisfaction in the world. You have to help other people to give up looking for satisfaction in the world. Because the basic thing about that, the basic thing about looking for satisfaction in the wrong places, desiring things that can't give you satisfaction, is that it makes you suffer. And if it makes you suffer, it makes other people suffer. And in the Mahayana movement, it's not just enough for me to be about, well, me being happy and me spiritually progressing. It was about others too. You couldn't leave others out of the picture, because we're all interconnected. And the idea of your own attainment is absolute nonsense. It's just nonsense. It doesn't mean a single thing for me to have any kind of spiritual attainment or for me to get enlightened. Because when you get to that kind of level, there's no difference between self and other. So the Mahayana really brought this out, that spiritual development is about everybody. It's just a bag of rubbish to talk about my own individual attainment. So, you know, they were really into this altruistic dimension, and they didn't just say it, they personified it. And the Mahayana came out with different archetypal forms that represented this altruistic dimension of Buddhist practice. So they had the altruistic, they had the different forms of the Buddha. So there wasn't one, just one historical Buddha. They brought out different aspect of the Buddha's experience, enlightenment experience, in what's called the five jhanas, or the mandala of the five Buddhas, which incidentally is what we're going to be looking at Castleton. We have got a theme. It's going to be the five Buddhas. Good. So they had other Buddha figures, a bit like Amitabha would be a very famous one. The Buddha of the West, of a deep red colour, like the colour of the setting sun, whose altruistic motivation was expressed through the wisdom of distinction, where he loved all beings in their uniqueness. He saw all beings as unique, all beings as special, all beings as lovable. And then they also had other archetypal forms which weren't Buddhas, but were these kind of spiritual heroes and heroines who didn't think about gaining enlightenment for themselves, but for all beings. So Bodhisattva figures like Tara, who represents the active compassion, active aspect of compassion, compassion and action, who's stepping down from her lotus feet, ready to plunge into the world to help all beings be enlightened. So it's like they took this figure of the Buddha, they took this object of longing, this archetypal form of spiritual rebirth, and they really ran with it. And they brought out all sorts of different forms, all sorts of different colours, all sorts of different symbols and hand positions, and everything became much bigger, much more meaningful, much more poetic. And then there was another movement called the Vajrayana, Vajra meaning truth, Yana vehicle. So this was the vehicle of truth. And the Vajrayana took the Mahayana a bit further, particularly with their visualization practices. So what happened was that as more people went deeper in their meditation, all these archetypal forms just kept emerging. And just like those early visualization traditions, someone would have this figure emerging in their meditation, And the figure would go through all sorts of kind of actions. And the meditator would get up and they would pass that on as a tradition so that other people would learn that form of visualization, practice it and have the same experience as the original meditator did. And what the Vajrayana did was that they said, well, actually, it's really important that in your Buddhist practice you take up what's called a yidam, or a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva figure, to develop a relationship with. You create a bond with that figure, what's called a samaya. And you develop an ongoing relationship with that figure, which is what we do at ordination. We take up a particular Buddha or a Bodhisattva figure and we develop a relationship with that figure. Developing a relationship with that figure is called a sadhana practice. Sadhana doesn't just mean visualization. It means an ongoing relationship. So it could mean chanting a mantra. It could mean, painting a picture or whatever. As long as you keep developing a relationship with your yidam or with your Buddha or Bodhisattva figure. And for this, it was terribly important for the Vajrayana. In fact, this figure became the Dharma refuge, or became the Buddha's teaching. So, well, why did the Vajrayana make such a big thing out of this aspect of Buddhism? Well, they made such a big thing out of it because what they saw is that words aren't enough. Words aren't enough to hook our longing. Words aren't enough to hook our desire into something that's going to work for us. Because we can use all the words we like for spiritual rebirth. We can use all the words we like for what we will become. But we won't develop that longing faith for those things unless that goal is personified. Unless what we can become is personified and made manifest. Because it's a peculiar thing about human beings is that they can't come into relationship with something unless it's personified. So you can think about compassion in the abstract. Well, there's this thing called compassion. But if I talk to you about an archetypal form or even a real person who is compassionate, if I start to talk to you about the Buddha or about Mother Teresa or about, all those people that people talk about in the beginner's course, Nelson Mandela and Gandhi and all sorts of things. If I started giving you a talk about the life of Mother Teresa or something, well, what I'd do is I'd spark something off in you. And what I'd spark off in you is your longing faith. And maybe even I'd spark off in you a bit of emotion, a bit of attraction towards that ideal. Whereas if I just talk about compassion in the abstract, it just won't do it. But if I talk about a compassionate person or a compassionate being, well, it will spark off something in you. It will spark off a little resonance. And you'll be much more engaged. You will come into relationship with those qualities. You know, if I started to talk about Avalokiteshvara, who loved the world so much that when he saw the amount of suffering that we put ourselves into, tears just fell out of his eyes and formed a vast lake. And out of that vast lake arose this form of Tara, who was dark, dark green, like a midnight in the forest, and who was was stepping off her lotus leaf with her hands outstretched, completely responding to every cry that the world threw up. If I started to talk about that, then maybe you'd understand what compassion really is. But if I just start to talk about compassion, you know, out of a book, well, it's what happens when metta meets suffering. It just won't do it for you. So we need things personified. We need to come into relationship with them. We need to see them made manifest, because then we know who we can become. And not only do we know who we can become, we long for what we can become. There's quite a few of us who went to Taraloka at the weekend, and Sangharakshita, who set up the order, was there. And it's interesting because he gave a little talk, and then he dedicated a new shrine room, and then he came and had tea with everyone afterwards. And, you know, he's an old man, and he's not really very charismatic. And he, you know, he did a good talk, and it was very thought-provoking, and said a lot of thought-provoking things. But you know what? When you talk to people about it afterwards, that's not what they brought out. What they brought out was just his tremendous presence. This old, shuffly, nearly blind man, you know, in his kind of tweed blazer. Marks and Spencer's trousers or whatever. He comes shuffling up, like, really old. And then he sits down, and he looks a bit bored when he's sitting down. He's sort of like this. And then he stands up to speak. And the power and the clarity and the full attention of what he's saying says so much more than the words. It's like just being around that old man who's given his life for the spread of the Dharma is almost overwhelming, actually. And people were sort of crying, you know. And in a way, well, he didn't say that much. It's just his presence. It's just who he is. And people felt such enormous devotion to him. And they felt such enormous devotion because in some way this funny guy in his 80s from Tooting Beck, who went to live in India for 20 years, somehow represents to us what we can become, that we can become those things too, that we can have that presence, have that energy, have that clarity, and have that deep love for the well-being of humanity. He talked to us at length about toilet paper and what colour is good for the world that we use, which is white. No dyed toilet paper is the new spiritual teaching. Anyway, slightly gone off again. Yes. So we respond more to people. We respond more to people. We respond more to colours. We respond more to images. We respond to symbols, to stories. And in the visualisation practices, those meditations, they have all those things. They have enough to hook our longing, enough to hook our attention and our attraction. They talk in a kind of dream language that plays out the Dharma in a way that we can understand on a deeper level than just our intellect. Bhante calls sadhana practices and visualization practices as dramatic enactments of enlightenment. In a way, it's that it's all kind of there, acting out. And you can engage with it in a bit more of a real way than you can when it's just spelt out. I know I had this experience, which I've said, on solitary, where I was doing loads of study. Every day I was up this mountain in Spain, doing all this study, for hours and hours and hours in the afternoon. And then after that, I'd put down my thing, I'd have a cup of tea, and I'd do my sadhana practice, I'd do my visualization practice, actually. And I'd think, oh God, it's just here. It's like all the study that I've just done is just being played out before my eyes. So it's like I've been managing to study on one level, which is engaging my intellect. But actually, this is engaging my heart with the same material. And here it all is. It's all here, but in a completely different language. So the key aspect of taking up a yidam, taking up a visualization practice, or a bond with a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, is to enter into a relationship with it, an emotional relationship, a longing relationship, a relationship of desire. What that's called in Sanskrit, which I'm more comfortable with, is the samaya sattva, the being of the bond, the being of the kind of oath. So you make a bond with this figure and you enter into a relationship with it. And by entering into a relationship with this figure, you're entering into a relationship with your own potential. So what you can do is you can see this as waking up your own potential within. It's one way of looking at it. Vasantra talks about this in terms of energy. And he says that actually we've got loads of energy. No one's got a problem with energy. Everybody's got enough energy. No problem with energy whatsoever. The problem is that it's dormant. The problem is that it's just not awake yet. And he says it's a bit like we've got caves underground. And in the caves underground are sitting these magicians and heroes and sages and dancers and kings and queens, warriors, all those things. They're all sitting in these caves. And they're fast asleep. And they're fast asleep because we're not paying them any attention. Because actually they can't get engaged with our slightly mediocre lives. You know, they just can't get engaged with bank accounts and what's on telly this evening and really where I'm going to go on holiday next year. You know, all the things, they're just fast asleep. It just doesn't really matter to them. And in a way, words alone won't wake them up. We need something to engage them. We need something that they can hook their desire onto. We need to speak their language. And in a way, yidams, these archetypal figures, have that power. They have the power to stomp through the dark cellars and wake all those figures up and say, here I am! I'm doing something worthwhile! We can all get up and go! We can go and conquer the world! Help all beings to be enlightened! So they have that power. They're quite excitable sort of chaps and chapesses, stomping through the dark cellars, saying, this is who you are. This is who you can be. You don't just have to be someone with a career and a bank balance and all the mundane stuff that goes on in life. You can be something so much bigger. So another way you can look at it is, well, we all have a voice inside of us that resonates with reality, that knows who we can become and that longs to be heard. And often that voice is just covered up with all sorts of stuff in life. It's covered up with kind of going to work, going home, watching the telly, all that sort of stuff. And yidams give this little voice a chance to speak. They can, this little voice inside us that longs for what's possible, can speak through this yidam, can speak through the archetypal Buddha or Bodhisattva figure in a language that's real to it. So you can look at it, yidams as waking up, or that relationship with the yidam as waking up something that's lying dormant within you. And sometimes the tantric visualizations, they start with you as the Bodhisattva. So my one does, I know one of Mogavanksa's does. It's quite a thing sometimes, 7:30 in the morning, being Tara. Sometimes I don't quite feel like that, but you know, it's a bond. Here she is. In a way, that point brings visualizing yourself as the Bodhisattva, visualizing yourself as your yidam does, kind of bring this point home, that it's waking up something dormant within you, something that you always knew was there, but you just needed to give a voice. So that's a completely fine way of looking at it, but there's just one little problem. And the problem is that if we see yidams in this way, they can just turn into some sort of Jungian archetype. Well, it's very psychologically interesting, you know, that we've all got these people in our cellars and that we've all got these archetypes. But it can remain as just a kind of some sort of psychological theory on our unconscious psyche. So, and often I do hear people talking about yidams in this way in terms of Jungian archetypes, which is kind of all right, but kind of misses something as well. It's kind of misses something. Because as some Tibetans say, some Tibetans means I've read it once and it was said by a Tibetan. They say, bodhisattvas exist from their own side. So you don't just visualize yourself as the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva visualizes itself as you. The bodhisattva becomes you. And in some visualization practices, you do visualize the bodhisattva as outside of you as well. In mine, I do both, which is quite a strange experience. So So from this point of view, when we visualise the Yidam, when we're performing a puja to the Yidam, we are calling something to us. We're calling something from outside of us into us. We're evoking something to come to us. We're evoking something bigger than us to pull us up. So I think for Westerners, this can be a little bit more tricky to accept, because you kind of think, well, isn't that just a bit like God? So I've got two kind of ways of thinking about this, and one of them is that if you're interconnected with all beings, you're also interconnected with the best of all beings. And if you're interconnected with everything, you can draw strength and inspiration from those elements in reality which are positive, which might even be transcendental. They transcend our ordinary small mind, our small way of thinking about things. That's Carmela Sheila's approach, actually. He says, well, if you're interconnected with everything, well, you're even interconnected with the Buddha. You're interconnected with that potential that sometimes manifests itself throughout space and time, which is called enlightenment. You're connected with a potential of enlightenment which always exists in all world systems throughout space and time. So that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is, in order for spiritual rebirth to emerge, we have to let in something bigger than our ordinary mind. So the way we do this, part of it is by making space for something bigger. And we make space for something bigger to emerge by renunciation, by spiritual death, by letting go of our expectations in things that just can't satisfy us. By moving away our Trishna or craving from things in the world to the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. That's spiritual death. And spiritual death makes space for something bigger to emerge. Spiritual rebirth is when you let that thing emerge. When you let something bigger take the place of that kind of worldly desires. Spiritual rebirth is when we long for the Dharma, when we long for the Buddha, when we long for the Sangha to be made manifest in us through our lives. So in a way, in spiritual rebirth, in sadhana practices, we allow this visualized Buddha or Bodhisattva to just completely possess us. To take the place of our ordinary, self-centered, limited, self-preoccupied mind. We just let the Bodhisattva take over. And in a way, what we do then is we let go of our old patterns. We let go of all the stuff that's holding us back, all the stuff that's meaningless and makes us suffer. And we embrace something much bigger than our ordinary mind, something much bigger than the ordinary me. So I have had this experience when I've been doing my visualization practice where Tara comes into me at one point and I just really want to vomit. Sometimes it's almost overpowering. I just want to vomit. Because actually it's really frightening. It's really frightening having something much bigger than you take you over. And actually, I quite like my ordinary mind. I quite like my small mind. It's kind of me. And I'm quite comfortable with me, actually. I'm quite a kind of positive, happy, healthy human being. And I don't really want to give that up in a very big hurry. And I definitely don't want to become someone who's very pale, with seven eyes, made out of white light, sort of a Buddha popping out of her head, letting off kind of moonbeams and rainbows. I don't know how that would just be walking down the street in Sheffield on a sort of Tuesday evening. So it is frightening. It is frightening because something much bigger than you comes into your life. But actually, it's frightening, but you do it for a reason. You don't just do it because you're going to look different and sound different. You do it because when you're Tara, when you're the Yidam, when you're this Buddha or Bodhisattva figure, you can love the world so much better. You can love the world so much better because your small mind, your self-preoccupation, your self-defences, all those things are gone. And when they're gone, you're just free to love the world. You're free to just send out compassion to all the world. You're free to make a real difference to other beings. But as long as you hold on to this self-preoccupation in this ordinary small mind, you just can't do it. You can't do it like Tara does it. You know, if I was Tara, I could just make such a difference. I could just be so bigger. In fact, it wouldn't be anything about me. It would just be about loving other human beings and being more and more connected with the world. So to me, that's worth it, actually. That's worth it to become this strange being, is if you could just love the world so much more. So, it is scary. And there is a little bit of a drawback as well from seeing the Bodhisattva and the Buddha figures as outside of yourself, which is that you can set them up as some sort of god. And then you can start praying to them for cars and clothes and houses and things like that. Which is, they're not really like that, actually. I don't think Tara really does give you houses. Well, she hasn't so far, anyway. But, you know, I'll keep trying. So, yeah, so there's drawbacks to both of those ways of looking at it. But the main point is that Yidams, archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are not just pretty images to put on the wall. They're not just nice pictures. They're not even just weird pictures from that strange aspect of Buddhism that we don't talk to about people unless they're on week 3 of the intermediate course. They're more than that. They're a relationship. And they're a relationship between us and who we can be, us and our potential. And they're not a dry relationship. They're a relationship of longing, a relationship of shraddha, a relationship of admiration. They're an aspect of longing faith, where we see and experience, really see and really experience who we could be, and we long for it, like we long for a lover. Because as human beings, we can't just give up our desire. We can't just say, right, I'm just not going to look for things in the world. We're passionate beings. And desire can be useful, it can motivate us, it can give us energy. What we need to do is we need to just pour that desire into something that will really work. That's something that will fulfill our expectations. That's something that really, really appeals to all those figures in the cave that are fast asleep. Parami gave a talk yesterday. It was yesterday. About how, in a way, well, what we need to do is move. The main thing about the spiritual life is to move our centre of gravity to something that's really meaningful, and then the rest of your life will sort itself out. So, in a way, Yidams do this for us. They help us to move our centre of gravity towards what we could be rather than what we were. So Yidams can do that. For a lot of people, they're their main spiritual practices. Archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they're what really shifts that centre of gravity. But for some people, they're just not. Some people just don't get them at all. For some people, they're just not a practice that they really engage with. So I think that's important to say because that's fine too. So there are a lot of order members who just find that whole aspect of the Buddhist tradition just really difficult. So if you're one of those people, that's fine. Actually, that's fine. But it may change.